Hi, welcome to Second Wind Women. I'm Karen Spies, and I'm here today with Amy Bernstein. Amy writes award-winning genre-crossing fiction and nonfiction. She's a professional book coach, and she helps nonfiction writers to develop great books that land agents and publishers. In her self-designated role as a doubt whisperer, Amy counsels writers and artists on managing a mindset for manifesting and sustaining a creative life. She writes weekly on Substack about managing creative challenges and teaches writing workshops around the country. Wow, that is a mouthful. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for making your way through that, and I'm glad to be here with you.
So when it sounds like, well, how did you decide you were going to become a writer? And first of all, because that's a big decision, right?
You know, I think that one way of looking at it is that writing chooses the person. The person doesn't choose writing. It's a very, very, very difficult thing to pursue. It's difficult to do well. It's a brutal kind of environment to be a writer. And I think that those of us who are out there doing it a lot feel compelled. So in that, that's what I mean by it chooses us. We don't choose it. Now, having said that, you know, I was an English literature major way back in college. I earned my living for decades as a journalist, as a communications director. So I've always been writing. And what I really like to tell people is it's really the only thing I can do well. I'm terrible at math. I have no sense of direction. I don't enjoy cooking. So really, what am I left with?
Oh my gosh, that's funny. Let's kind of start at the beginning. So you were an English major and you became a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what kind of journalism did you do?
Well, you know, my very, very, very first job out of college was learning literally how to write in a journalistic style. And I worked for the world's most boring magazine, hands down. It was called Risk Management. It was about insurance. But much as I wasn't thrilled to learn and study up on the world of insurance, I had an amazing boss who was the managing editor who taught me how to report a story, how to write a story, how to do it. Because, you know, back in the day when you were an English major, it was you were all grounded in literature, right? So I was reading, you know, Victorian literature and great novels, right? It had nothing to do with journalism or practical or applied writing. So that first job, I'll always be grateful to, because she really taught me how to kind of do what journalists do, which was mm-hmm. great.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long were you there?
Oh, I don't know. This magazine was a really long time ago. I don't know.
A while.
Not terribly long. Not terribly long. No, we're moving on.
So when did you decide to transition into writing your own books?
Well, that's a lifetime of a story, right? So, you know, I wrote for many decades being paid to do the work of other institutions and other people and serving their needs and their priorities. And I always, you know, when I was in my 20s, I remember taking a lunch break from a job where I was writing, doing communications work, and I would go sit out on the lawn in the local park, and I was trying to write a romance novel at longhand. I mean, because this is way before the personal computer. And I just, you know, I just didn't know what I was doing, and there was no one to encourage me and tell me to keep going. So naturally, I gave up. But I remember that I had that impulse really early. And, you know, I buried a lot of those creative writing impulses for a long time to make a living. And somewhere in that great pivot we call midlife, I realized, you know what? The time is only growing shorter. If you're going to do this, you're going to do this. You're going to start doing this. And I began a really, really major mindset to make a priority to write my own stuff and take those risks and just start developing that side of the craft. And boy, I'm so glad I did that.
Was there like an incident or something or a moment, or you just kind of like, I'm over this? Or was there like a turning point where you're
oh,
like,
there was a moment. We could make a movie out of this moment.
Oh,
so
okay,
so
like
I was commuting to Washington, D.C. I was working for the federal government at the time. This was years ago, before all the current nonsense. I live in Baltimore, so it was only an hour to get to D.C., but hour plus on the train. It's not a pleasant commute. So I was kind of at the end of my rope. I was feeling very empty inside. I was feeling extremely burned out. Ironically, I was making more money than I ever imagined anyone would pay me, given my English degree. And it didn't matter. I was really, really, really unhappy. And I remember standing on the train track one ordinary morning, and my train heading south would arrive on one side, and the regular train or the Amtrak heading to New York in this normal morning routine was just right across the same platform. I came very close to simply turning around and getting on the train to New York and not going back to work and not telling anybody. Well, for me, that was a warning cry, because it's just not who I was. And I was really close to doing it. And I realized, you know what? Something has to change. I can't keep doing this. And I really committed to it in that moment. Like, I'm almost crying. I almost cry every time I tell this story. It's very powerful to me.
Yeah. So it was just like a regular day where things had gotten so bad that you suddenly realized that you were fantasizing about ways to escape, basically.
Absolutely. Yes, big time. And you know, a lot of people depend on me. I had a very responsible, high-pressure job. I couldn't do that, but I almost did it. And I sometimes wonder what would have really happened if I had. What would have happened? I would have called in sick. Would it have really helped me make up my mind any more quickly? I don't think so. I think merely toying with that notion so realistically was enough for me to tell me, you've got to change. You got to make a change. Right. You got to get out of here and do something else.
So how did you make that transition?
You know, I like to tell everyone who's thinking about like what I call the pivot, the midlife pivot. It doesn't have to be dramatic or all at once. And you don't have to throw over your current life and embrace a new life. You can do that. Most of us can't really make change that way. So I started making small changes, and I found that small changes led me to bigger changes. So for example, I enrolled in a playwriting class, which I could just do on the weekend or, you know, one Saturday morning a week or something. And I met playwrights and I started writing plays, and I found a playwriting community, and that led to writing more plays and beginning to sort of develop myself as a writer. And that was a really small but incredibly powerful change that I was able to make, to begin to embrace an identity that I wanted, but didn't feel that was me. And so I always say, you know, change begins with small steps, particularly if you want to lean into a more creative life. You can start very small, smaller than I did even, and it can still be very real. And that makes it possible.
Yeah, I love what you're saying about identity. So were you maintaining your job as you were building this new identity for yourself?
That's right. That's right. This wasn't something where I had to suddenly miss work or things of that nature. And, you know, I had a young child at home and, you know, a husband who does a lot. And so I was fortunate to have that kind of help. And I remember, I'm sort of stunned when I think back on it. I was also younger. You know, I remember I signed up for write a play. You have to do the 24-hour play challenge. You have to stay up all night, write the play, turn it in so they can perform it the next day. And I remember sitting there at my computer at 2 or 3 in the morning thinking, what are you doing? What is this? But it was so much fun and I was so into it. And so that's what I mean. When you start making the small changes, they have a real ripple effect on you. And then you realize you can start embracing slightly larger changes until you begin to, the changes that you want to see within you start to happen, and you can begin to find a new way forward.
Right. So you have like the support of this community, this playwriting community, for example, to help you not only think, oh, I could be a playwriter, but oh, I'm part of a group of playwriters. It's just, you have this external support for your new identity.
Yes, and it's so important. You've got to find who are your people? You've got to find your community. It is so important to do that. And, you know, you can't do this all on your own. The impulse has to come from you alone, but then you do want to find a community that's going to support you and not question your every move and tell you you're crazy. So it's important to do that. Yes.
And I mean, so my personal example is that I've been playing guitar alone for years, years and years and years. It's just in my house, playing some guitar, singing, whatever. And my brain is saying, oh, nobody needs to see this. You're not that good. You're just doing it for your own enjoyment. But then when I go out and play with other people, I'm like, wait, hold on. I can actually do this. I think it can really take you out of the cage of your own self-doubt, right?
Absolutely. And that is such a beautiful example of what happens when we're willing to embrace the risks that come with practicing an art form. And that by risk, what I mean is in this case, in your case, and in my case, to some extent as well, you simply have to be willing to be vulnerable to let your art show. And you know, maybe you don't have all the finger picking skills of the one next to you, or maybe you don't have the power of voice that other singer has. That's not relevant. what's relevant is that you get the joyful experience of practicing right. your art with other artists, where it's that communal experience. There's just no substitute for that. And yes, it really helps us remember that we're not just alone in these needs and feelings, that we can do this communally.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, it's so easy to be hard on yourself. You know, I'm trying to play classical guitar pieces at home. I'm like, I'm not that good. What?
Well,
And
this is one of the problems, is we're in a cult. This just gets me every time. And you just said it. I'm not that good. We're in a culture where everything boils down to you're good at this or you're bad at this. You know, you show up on social media looking like this incredible expert of all time, or you don't show up at all. Like, we're just, it's a very punitive culture where if we're not quote unquote good, great, the best, we're just the opposite. We're terrible. We're losers. We're whatever. Nobody, you know, nobody's going to care. That's just, those are all the wrong measures, all the wrong measures. With any form of art making, or even entrepreneurship, or you want to open a retail store, whatever it is, with any creative endeavor, it's not about meeting somebody's definition of the best or the good per se. It's about really embracing the joy, the passion, and the need to do that thing so that you feel like a whole human being. That's what matters. And when you're out there playing guitar with those folks, who cares if you're not the best one in the room? I mean, it's so irrelevant, right? And once you're out there doing it, you realize, oh, I didn't have to worry about that. That wasn't the thing.
Right. How much do you think of that thing? Sorry. How much of that? Right. So I got my bachelor's degree in fine art, and I've been around artists and theater people my whole life. And it seems to me that there's always such a emphasis on monetization. And I think that really feeds that self-doubt, because that's how we value, right? You can say, oh, well, you wrote this book. Well, did anybody buy it? Right. And it kind of reinforces that, you know, reinforces in the hesitancy and your self-doubt, right? Because of that's how the value is actually measured in that way, when really art should be measured by emotional response or intellectual response, not by dollars and cents.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, we make art to connect, to reflect on the human experience, and to make connections with other human beings, sometimes at a nonverbal level. We don't make art necessarily because it's going to put food on the table, or because someone's going to actually, you know, give us hard currency simply because we're there making the art. Of course, people do that. But that can't be the only reason. And again, our culture shows us the multimillion, I've called it like the Taylor Swift disease. You know, she's a billionaire, right? Rihanna is a billionaire. These are outliers who they found a way to monetize their art. Okay, but most of us, that's not how we're going to live our lives. Hmm. We have to do it for all these other reasons. And we should be doing it for all these other reasons. And yes, when you know, family members, they look at us, they say, well, yeah. Or like my dad used to say, well, you know, you're going to make any money with those books? It's like, it's really not the point, Dad. It's really not.
Yeah. Yeah. The interplay between the compulsion to create art and the value assigned to it, and the naysayers, you know, who just, yeah, poke at us. So you work now with people who are authors, and do you work with people who are already established authors, or people who are just like, I have this compulsion to write and I don't know what to do with it? What are the kind of people that you're working with?
My clients definitely run a gamut, but I tend to work with subject matter experts who are not necessarily writers, but they have a phenomenal grasp of their field, and they have a really wonderful idea for information that kind of needs to be shared with the world. It could be a point of view. It could be a contrarian point of view. It could be something they, you know, it could be an expose. There could be any number of ways of getting at it. But I'm working with a person right now who is incredibly gifted in helping teens get over some of their organizational dysfunction and executive function problems. And so there's someone writing a book that's really going to speak to parents of teens. And so I love working with problem solvers, right? And so I always talk about the need for, we're going to develop a book that has a compelling reason to exist in the world because somebody needs it. It's not just because I just want to look great, or I'm just burnishing my reputation, or I'm just, you know, I just, you know, putting words on page for no particular reason. There's got to be a lot of heart and soul and meaning and connection behind it. So I'm working with people who are very intentional about the message they want to share with the world. It's a really wonderful experience.
So mainly nonfiction?
Yes. I write fiction and nonfiction. And in fact, I have a novel coming out I'm very excited about. Because of my journalism background and my deep background in government and corporate communications, I really prefer to coach nonfiction and very selectively some folks writing memoir, but that's a much tougher road there. And so, but yes, nonfiction in almost any field, it's really fun to help people just bring ideas to life that are passionate and interesting and really are going to connect with readers.
So what do you think is the most common kind of pitfall that these people, right, who are come from a factual kind of background in writing a nonfiction book?
Yeah.
What's the most common thing that they struggle with?
It's a couple of things and they're all related. It's people who are not practiced writers, writing is not what they've done as a cultivated skill or profession. Obviously, we all write as part of our jobs, but that's different from sustaining long-form writing like book length or even major essay length material. Most people haven't done that. They don't realize how essential it is to get very, very clear about what the actual idea or premise of the book is and how you're going to structure it so that premise unfolds in a logical and compelling way. Structure is the be-all and end-all of a great nonfiction book. And structure grows out of understanding what the book is really about and who it's really for. And as simple as that sounds, it's the hardest thing that every writer grapples with.
I mean, that makes sense to me, especially if you're already so ingrained in that information. It's like if you talk to somebody who's an expert in electricity, and they would just go about stuff you have to know your audience and structure. That's interesting. Because as a reader, you don't really think of that. But if it doesn't progress logically, you're going to lose the reader, right?
That's exactly right. And that means it wasn't structured well. And structure encompasses many things. It's the author's voice. It's the point of view. It's how you tell story. It's many different things. But I'm constantly working with my writers on what I call the container. What's the container for this book? And that gets at what's the story we're telling? What's the best way to tell it? Who needs to be on the page? Who doesn't? What's in? What's out? Where is your voice as the author in the story? And these are all really powerful, difficult, necessary questions that author has to grapple with.
It reminds me of branding and like you've heard of brand voice, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, where people think they're like, oh, it's branding. Just give me a logo. It'll be fine.
No, it's a little more than that.
Way more putting thought into something, you end up with such a better product, and it's, you know, it's like you're trying to subvert the hindsight is 2020 thing, right? Once you're done, then you don't want to have to go back and be like, oh, I can see now that this should have been done this way.
Right. And also there's a big difference between information and a point of view. Information is just anything at all you want to put out there that you can string a bunch of facts together and that's information. Just do a dump of stuff that's in your head and that's information. That's not a point of view. A book needs a really clear point of view. So it's incredibly curated. And that's the other hard part of this is understanding how to curate what you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look at social media. People are always struggling with curation there, right? Trying to know who they are and all that. So you had something in your intro about teaching people to lead a more creative life. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, coming out of my work writing Wrangling the Doubt Monster, which is the book I wrote to inspire all self-doubting creatives sort of in all fields and all walks of life. Coming out of that, I've run a number of creativity workshops that have attracted a really diverse array of multimedia artists who are struggling to really embrace their own artistry and their own commitment to it. In other words, struggling to take themselves seriously. And what I've uncovered through these workshops is the blockages that we carry. So many of us have been brought up not to value creative impulses, but to put those to the side in favor of more practical things. Right. And we're often discouraged from developing the artist within us. And so we carry that into adulthood. And here these folks arrive, even in early adulthood or midlife, and they've suppressed and repressed all the most creative parts of themselves. And now they want to open the door and let that out again. It's not it's fear, yes, but it's mostly this notion of not allowing it to be valuable because we've always been told it's not valuable. You know, as kids, we had no trouble finger painting and making up games and making up songs because we were allowed to take the time and the space to do that. And when we got older, that was not allowed, mostly. I mean, obviously, right. If you're majoring, if you go to an arts high school, you know, you're that rare kid who gets to do it. But most of us just don't get that chance again. And so it's really hard to open those doors again and give ourselves permission, which is a really big part of this, is giving yourself permission to sort of be creative, to experiment, to fail, to take those risks. And people struggle to do that. So in these creativity workshops, we explore a lot of those.
That sounds like really transformative for people who are feeling stuck in that way. What can you share like some examples of how that has changed people, you know, not just in the fact that before I couldn't barely do watercolor, now I can do watercolor, but what's the overarching, like, more holistic changes that people experience from valuing and getting more in touch with their creativity?
Well, I started saying it already. It really starts with giving yourself literal permission to do the thing. You have to give yourself permission to take the time to experiment with this craft, whatever it is. And so particularly working parents who are, you know, in a workshop like this, you know, they've got jobs, they've got family responsibilities, and they express how guilty they feel. I can't take time for that. I want to do it, but it's a really low priority. I can't do it. And I always argue, no, this is part of you expressing yourself as a human being. Making art is being human. Expressing ourselves artistically, however you interpret that, is being human. We are allowed to be human. We are not just functioning caregivers, spouses, shoppers, cooks, valets. Like, that's not all we are. And so when I have these conversations with people, when they reach a point where they realize, I have that time in the morning, and I'm going to use that time in the morning for myself. And I'm allowed to do this. And I know that when they do that, that's when things start opening up. That's when your practice starts to open up. So you mm-hmm. must give yourself permission and release yourself from this feeling like a guilty waste of time. Our culture makes it very hard to make that break. And that's really essential.
Yeah. Yeah. And also there's a huge difference in, I mean, we tell ourselves it's wasting time, but how many of us waste time by watching Netflix or, you know, other things that I always used to tell my kids, be a creator, not a consumer.
I love that.
Right? Because we have plenty of time, but we're spending it consuming art, right? Or consuming stories by other people.
Right. Well, I think too that we don't realize that, okay, so daily life is exhausting. So we turn to, you know, Netflix or whatever, just basically relax, right? Put that part of our brain to sleep. We just consume passively because we're kind of exhausted from all the things coming at us all day. But when you commit to a creative practice, you find new ways of feeling energized. And so it taps into different parts of your brain that you didn't realize really you weren't using that as much as you could or should. And you get energized all over again.
Right, right. Did you ever do that? Are you familiar with the Artist Way? Did you ever do the Artist Way?
No. I mean, I know it's famous. And I like to think that Doubt Monster is sort of a successor book and ethos to that, because that's been around for decades. But no, I never like got into the practice.
Yeah, I went to art school. I did all those things. I went to one meeting where people were doing the Artist Way, and it was way too structured for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't try and give people structure. I try and let them basically, it's more of a seeing how to open themselves up. Mm-hmm. It's not about structure.
So what do you write about in your Substack?
So the Substack is called Doubt Monster, and the book is Wrangling the Doubt Monster. But really, the Substack over the last couple of years has really become a loose exploration of what it is to be a creative person, of what the struggles are like, of what the challenges are like, how it actually feels. I've done some craft work, meaning helping people understand certain things about the writing craft, but I also have written much more broadly about how we deal with doubt and anxiety and things of this nature. So it's pretty wide ranging. I just finished a post today, really opening myself up as a case study and what it really took for a book that I started in 2018 that's only getting published now. It's taken all this time. And what's that journey like to really just about give up on something, on a creative dream. But when you don't give up on it, what happens? So I explore all these kinds of things about aspects of just being creative.
So there's a book, I forget who the author is, but there's a book about, I think they call it being multi-passionate. And she talks about if you have different kind of endeavors, that you have like a shelf and you're like, here's my macrame section. Here's my putting together computer section. So is that kind of what happened with your book, where you kind of like just had it on, you were just letting it marinate? Or were you actually like, I don't think I'm going to do this?
Do you mean, I'm sorry, which book are you talking about?
The book that you said you started in 2018.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, what happened there was, I mean, I'm sort of a case study in what it means to be gritty, to practice grit in a creative life. Because it's very easy to give up, because the world will hand you a lot of rejection, and it's hard to do things in creative spheres. There are many things telling you not to do things in creative spheres. And there are many places that don't want your work and all that kind of stuff. Long story short, I wrote this book really mostly in 2019, and I couldn't find an agent or a publisher, and I tried for a long time. And it was almost like a death to me. I almost felt like at a certain point, it's as though I'd lost a family member. In other words, this thing was, it just seemed like it was just not alive. And that was really, really hard for me to accept. Meanwhile, I'd written books before, and I went off and wrote another one, but I couldn't let it go. So after it was fallow for, you know, a while, I gave up on it for a short while. I let it sit in the dark room like a mushroom, you know, for a couple of years there, pulled it back out, made some more revisions. And lo and behold, I found a publisher who really, really wanted the book. And now it's coming out this spring, and I'm very excited about that. But it's just a lesson in what it means to persevere in the face of so much the universe telling you no. And once you learn that lesson in one sphere, you can carry that lesson into every sphere of your life, really.
Yeah, I've heard somebody say basically like, God is testing if you really want this. The universe is saying, you say you want this. How do you really want it?
Right. That's absolutely true. And that was true with this particular book. You wrote it. You believe in it. No one else believed in it. How much do you really believe in it? Well, I believed in it enough to try again. I mean, I queried over 200 literary agents, which is absurd. And so the universe was really telling me, no. But like, no, it's not a bad book. No, it's not a bad book.
I mean, that's so much of the arts in general, particularly in our cultural climate, I think, that perseverance, because I think that just doubles down on the self-doubt, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
because that's so hard to have that perseverance when you have the self-doubt.
That's right. And that's why I always say that we can learn to walk with our doubts. We cannot banish them. So doubt is always going to be there with you. But you've got to recognize that the negative voices and the voices that hold you back and the voices that tell you don't try or stop trying or you're not worth it, they'll be as loud as you let them. But if you practice some sort of mindful mind shift exercises, you have to realize that there are other tapes in your head that deserve to be heard just as loudly. You can tell yourself, remind yourself of all the times when you have been competent and successful. Remind yourself of the times when you've beaten the odds. Those things matter. And so the doubt doesn't go away, but it is not the only voice. You don't have to let it be the only voice. It's very important to strike that balance.
Right. Yeah. There's a great quote by Thich Nhat Hanh where he talks about, you know, take the negative thoughts in your head and realize that they're trying to protect you from feeling hurt. They're not negative. They're not like your bitchy friend. They're actually being like, oh, it's the same thing. Like keep your goals from the trolls, right? Why so many people find their families not that supportive, because they see how much perseverance you have to have, right? And they don't want to see somebody they love go through that much rejection.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I wrote an essay over the Christmas holiday that I published on Medium that was very much about when it was writer focused, but you could substitute the word artist, when you're the only writer in your family and you go home and you're not understood. And what is that about? And I bring up the point that you're making, which is that they're fearful for you. They don't understand the nature of the risks that you're taking and why they matter to you. They're fearful for you. You're not going to make money. You're not going to make a living. You're going to fall on your face. You're going to be embarrassed. you're not going to get ahead. Like all these things that our culture makes us fearful of, they are fearful for you for those things. And so it is a protective instinct. It's not that they don't usually just want you to fail. They're just scared for you.
Right.
And I have this little speech I've written for everybody to give to those loved ones, which is along the lines of, you know, I hear you and I really appreciate that you're looking out for me. The truth is I'm really happy with the choices I've made. And if it's making you uncomfortable, we don't have to really talk about that stuff anymore. If I want to stop being a writer, if I want to stop being an artist, it's too hard. I will let you know. So what it's really like, back off. I'm fine.
Yeah.
You're not fine with it, but I'm fine with it. And you can sort of make that separation.
That's very wise. So when you work with artists and you help them find like an agent, you know, how do you get these writers to a place where they're like, I know it's ready.
Excuse me. Tell them when it's ready. They don't know.
Okay.
Well, and in nonfiction, you don't have to have the whole book written.
Oh,
fiction.
Really?
In fiction, you have to have the novel completed and polished and edited and all that kind of stuff. In nonfiction, we create a proposal that includes sample chapters and a very, very detailed outline of the whole rest of the book. So you have to understand the book. You don't have to have it completely, fully written out. And it's very hard to write a very competitive proposal. And that's what I work with a lot of my authors toward doing.
Okay. I didn't know. I assumed you would have to have the whole book done.
In memoir, you do, but in most nonfiction, you don't.
Okay. Industry knowledge. You heard it here. So you run workshops, and who are you working with in these workshops? What, tell us about your workshops.
The workshops are, most of the workshops that I do are around creative writing or nonfiction. Because I write fiction and nonfiction, I have a pretty good understanding of both. And so I absolutely have a passion for communicating, teaching, and helping other writers simply get a better handle on some aspects of this difficult craft that we all practice. So I'm speaking at the San Francisco Writers Conference next month. I'm going to be doing some keynotes at the Atlanta Writers Conference in the spring. And I teach a lot of online workshops and in person when it comes up on just all kinds of things mostly about aspects about writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or strategies around those things. So we get really deep into it. And it's a joy to sort of work through these puzzles together. Even though I'm teaching, I see it as a very collaborative endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So what would you say to somebody who's kind of like you described yourself, who writing has chosen them and they're kind of like me playing guitar in my living room alone. They're just writing and filling up their bookshelves. What would you say to somebody that could give them, or what plan of action would you suggest for somebody to kind of get them to break out and see how they can impact the world around them with what's coming out of their brain?
Yeah, I think starting small, I think you're describing someone who has not yet crossed that threshold of being vulnerable, which means sharing their art or sharing their art making. You do have to, and it can be, if you're a writer, it can be submitting your first story to someplace, knowing that they may reject you, and you have to be prepared to take that. I do think that finding other people who are practicing your art form or aligned to your art form, and they're doing it from the same place that you're doing this. They're coming from the same place you are. They're coming from a place of joy, passion, fun, exploring the art itself, learning to get better, but not in a super competitive way. If you can find like-minded people like that, you're going to find a pretty safe space. And I'm saying it this way, because it's not like in your case, if you suddenly decided to go find a professional, you know, professional guitar group or something like that, you might feel super intimidated, or you might feel out of your league or shut down or doubtful, right?
So I would be out of my league.
Well, right. So that's misaligned, and it's not speaking to you. So you want to find the people who are doing what they're doing for the same reasons that you are. Mm-hmm. Now, over time, there's lots of talk in the writer community about, would I rather be in a writing critique group where I think all the writers are better than I am and they're going to lift me up? Or do I want to be with people who are so much on my level that I'm going to not feel overly challenged or intimidated? And you could kind of make a case either way. But you want to be thoughtful and intentional about what's going to work for you and what do you really need and want from that communal experience. If you really just want the joy of, you know, banging on pots and pans and calling it music, that's fine. Just go do it.
Right. Find other pot bangers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you'll all be pot bangers together and you'll be reinforcing your identity as pot bangers and maybe you'll become professionals.
And if you're that person who hasn't taken that, like, it, let's suppose you hadn't taken that step out of your own house with the guitar, you need to realize that everybody else is just as self-doubting and insecure about this as you are. You are not the only one. We think we're alone feeling this way. It's universal. There's so much comfort when you get around these other people and you realize they're just as scared and clueless as you are. You know, that's not just a you thing, right? It's not just a me thing. It's an us thing.
Yeah. 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 I'll never forget. I met this woman and we're driving somewhere and she's like, oh, I'm a painter. And I'm like, really? Where? Like, I didn't know that about you. I didn't know you were a painter. And she's like, yeah, I don't really show them to anybody. And I don't know what happened. I got really intense with her. And I'm like, how dare you? How dare you create something that's amazing and beautiful and not share it with other people? And she's like, oh shit, I never thought of it that way before.
Well, you guilt tripped her.
I did. I mean, for her benefit. Uh-huh. It hurt more her more than it hurt me. So how can people find you, Amy?
People should, I have two websites, but I prefer that people start with my author website and they can find my book coaching links from there if they're interested. It's amywrites.live, A-M-Y. URITES.live, LIVE, and you can find all my books, including the new one that's coming out, and Doubt Monster, and everything else, More Than You Want to Know About Me.
And your workshops?
Yes, there's information on there too.
Fantastic. It's been a real joy talking with you, Amy.
You too, very much.
Yeah, thanks for being.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching today. I'm glad you watched the whole thing. If you could do us a favor, it would help so much if you hit subscribe. It helps give us just a little boost to keep this podcast going. Thank you.